Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
I'm Regina Vaidyanathan, and for the BBC World Service, I've been travelling across America, talking to people in rural and urban areas, to policymakers and activists and ordinary Americans, in their homes, schools and churches, to investigate an issue which has dominated the headlines and the conversation here in America for the past few years. It's an issue characterised by one of this country's most prominent thinkers as the problem of the 20th century. Yet, at the start of the 21st, it's still at the top of the agenda. He called it the colour line. These days, we describe it as race.
What do we want? Justice! What do we want? Now! Justice!
The realities of racism have troubled this nation since before it was born. But President Obama's election to the White House led many Americans to believe their country was now post-racial, a place where, finally, being black wasn't a barrier to living the American dream. But over the last few years, that illusion's been shattered. The reason's simple enough. The killings of unarmed black people by the police and the protests, sometimes violent, which have followed.
Don't shoot!
Hands up!
Don't shoot!
I've reported from those protests all across America, but now I'm going back for a deeper look. America's struggle with race shows no sign of quietening unless some of the underlying issues are resolved. So I want to explore those deep-rooted structural problems, whether it's in education, housing, or the economy, and in each case, find some possible solutions. But I'm going to start where the debate started, with the criminal justice system.
If they had you, have you seen us?
If they had you, have you seen us?
You tell them we're going to Nicodemus.
Tell them we're going
I began the journey on the flat plains of Nicodemus, Kansas, a place barely touched by the hand of industrialization. Dusty tracks crisscross fields of corn, which go on as far as the eye can see. Little seems to have changed since this township was created in 1877 by free black citizens who moved and settled here after the end of slavery. Every year, the descendants of this town's first inhabitants gather for an annual reunion, complete with a fashion show, history session, and parade.
That sounds right!
Yet here in Nicodemus, a place which in many ways is about as far from the protest as it's possible to get, the concerns of the wider black community are never far from the surface. Just after I arrived, as my producer was still parking the car and I was making my way to collect my wristband for the weekend, I found myself chatting to Derek Moore, one of the younger attendees. It didn't take long for the conversation to turn to criminal justice and the actions of some police officers towards black men.
It's been going on for a long time, I feel like. It's been going on for a long time. And the only reason that everybody didn't know about it as much before then because we didn't have camera phone. You know, now anybody, all it takes is fine, pull out a camera phone, and now you're on camera. Now it's so much more in the media because of camera phones.
What sort of run-ins have you ever had with the police?
That my party that I threw my senior in high school, it was no violence going on. I did nothing wrong. I just had a bunch of friends over, a bunch of loud music and stuff like that. And the police got called over. And I answered the door, was pulled out to the front, to the middle of the street, and immediately grabbed and put in handcuffs. And then was slammed. And then got pulled into a car and taken to jail for resisting arrest. All for nothing, really. You know, I was in front of my house, nothing. You know what I mean? No reason to resist arrest, which I was not doing. From then on, I had court cases that I had to deal with. I had a resisting arrest case that I had to deal with.
So what happened in court then?
It went on for about 6-7 months, and they finally dropped it off. They dropped it. They dropped my case. But initially, me going to jail, I feel I live in that nice neighborhood in a very nice house. I honestly don't feel like sometimes people, when the police pull up to houses like that, they don't expect a black person to walk outside there.
Derek's experience might not be as extreme as other cases which make the headlines and spark protests, but it's part of a wider reality. Almost every single black American I've met in my 2 years of reporting on race in this country has shared a story of heavy-handedness from the police, whether it's being stopped driving a nice car or being followed in a shop. These are experiences they believe would never happen if they were white. What's more, they don't think it makes a difference if, like Derek, you come from a wealthy family or live in a wealthy neighbourhood. On Sunday morning, many of those in Nicodemus crammed into the small church to sing hymns, praise God, and express their pride in the community and the family ties which hold people together generations on. The service was powerful and emotional. People danced, clapped, and even cried. But then something happened which surprised me. Some of the worshippers stepped forward to ask the congregation to pray for them as they faced personal troubles.
I have a son who has been incarcerated for a number of months, and he is finally going to court on Friday.
That was Francine Giles Talbot, and I spoke to her afterwards.
As I stated in the church, I have a son who is incarcerated here in the state of Kansas. My son is accused of selling drugs. Marijuana, first offense, and I am a corrections officer. I have worked in the prison system here in Kansas, and I now work in the jail in Salina, Kansas. And I see, personally speaking for me, the injustice. I think from an African-American standpoint that African-American men, especially here in this state, they have a bad rap when it comes to drug offenses. I've seen a number of people come and go with the same charges that my son has. And they go and they get community corrections. They're put on community correction, 5-10 years community corrections. And they come in with a $1 million bond and walk out. But these are Caucasians that I see. The African-American men that come in, they are in for a year, 2-3 years before they can even go to trial.
And this is the first time
he's ever had anything like this.
And given that you work in the correction system yourself, mm-hmm. What do you think needs to change?
Nonviolent offenses should not be warranted a person's whole life being taken away from them. First-time offenders, why not give them community corrections or probation? Let them come back out and try to be productive citizens. You know, 10, 15 years is what he's looking at. He's 27 years old. He has 2 children. He's an able-bodied man that can work.
Francine's story gets to the heart of a deeper issue, which touches almost every black community in this country. That it's not just the police, but the entire criminal justice system which affects black Americans disproportionately. According to the advocacy group The Sentencing Project, 1 in 3 black men in the United States is likely to spend time behind bars at some stage in their life. And black men are 6 times more likely to be incarcerated than white men. And often the entry point to the criminal justice system is a non-violent drug offence, or even something as mundane as parking fines. For example, in Missouri, just east of Kansas, statistics from 2014 showed that while blacks were more likely to be stopped, more likely to be searched, and much more likely to be arrested by police, they were actually less likely to be carrying drugs and illegal weapons than whites.
The racial dimensions of mass incarceration can't simply be explained by crime or crime rates. At every stage of the criminal justice process, from stops and searches to plea bargaining and sentencing, there are staggering racial disparities.
That's Michelle Alexander, an associate professor at Ohio State University and the author of The New Jim Crow, a book which uses a wealth of data to present a picture of a deeply racially biased criminal justice system. It's become a runaway bestseller. And in it, she argues that the so-called war on drugs has been particularly important.
Studies have consistently shown that people of color are no more likely to use or sell illegal drugs. But if you are stopped and frisked and placed under nearly constant surveillance, the communities that are subject to this kind of surveillance and control are far more likely to have their loved ones, their sons, their daughters, their parents arrested. Studies have also shown that, you know, with respect to marijuana enforcement, the disparities are extreme. African Americans are at least 3 to 4 times more likely to be arrested for marijuana possession. And in some counties, African American men are more than 30 times more likely to be arrested for simple possession of marijuana, even though they're not any more likely to be guilty of drug crimes. One of the things I think escapes people's understanding is that being arrested and being swept into the criminal justice system is just the beginning of the odyssey for most people. For once you're swept into the criminal justice system, you're ushered into a parallel social universe in which the basic civil and human rights that apply to others no longer apply to you. For the rest of your life, employment discrimination is perfectly legal against you. Housing discrimination becomes legal against you. You may be denied the right to vote. You may be automatically excluded from juries. You may be denied access to financial aid for schooling or for access to college. Basic public benefits, including federally funded food stamps, may be off limits to you. In many ways, our criminal justice system and the system of mass incarceration has turned back the clock on racial progress for millions of people of color in the United States.
Some critics argue that for that clock to move forward, blacks in America need to do more themselves, and that complaining about the legacy of slavery or the era of Jim Crow merely holds the advancement of black people back. But Michelle's got a very different perspective.
One of the disastrous consequences of the war on drugs and mass incarceration has been the conflation of blackness and criminality in the public imagination. For many mainstream white Americans in particular, it is common to think of drug dealers, drug criminals as black. There was a study done back in the 90s that asked survey respondents to close their eyes and imagine a drug criminal. More than 95% of the respondents imagine someone who is African American. Less than 5% imagine someone of any other race or ethnicity. And the prospect of having young kids of color grow up in a world in which they are presumed guilty and their skin makes them suspect is devastating for their own identities and self-concept, but it is also potentially fatal to a successful, thriving, multiracial, multi-ethnic democracy in which every view, every voice, and every life is treated as though they truly matter.
I can't see that I'm sorry for the things that we've done.
Well, Michelle Alexander's time has come. The shift in the criminal justice system is starting to happen. And the push for change comes from an unlikely quarter. Not from liberals, but from conservatives, normally associated with tough-on-crime policies. In early 2015, Les Seiler, a state senator in conservative Nebraska, persuaded his colleagues to pass a law, number 605, which he believes will have a huge impact there.
Midnight in prison store.
What 605 basically does is recategorizes crime, and as far as sentencing is concerned, the violent crimes will still be heavy felonies, and they will have to spend some time in prison. That makes up about 60% of our prison population. The other 40% is basically nonviolent crimes, money transaction, drug-related, that type of crimes. And so we're looking at those to be putting them out on supervised release and spending the money on parole officers and getting those inmates back in the workforce, earning money so that their families are being supported by them, not the state, and not sitting in prison doing nothing.
For BBC World Service, I visited Senator Seiler in the law office which bears his name in the small, conservative town of Hastings, Nebraska. It was a bittersweet day for him, his last as a lawyer after nearly half a century. And so he took the opportunity to reflect on how his time as a lawyer, and not a professional politician, have affected his view on why criminal justice policy needs to change.
As a lawyer and as a defense counsel, I saw that the drug program is throw the key away, and then it leached into the other crimes, and we got the mandatory minimums and those type of things to really punish them. And it didn't work. It just didn't work.
And you say that you saw that as a lawyer.
As a lawyer.
You must have seen then that African Americans have been disproportionately affected by some of these policies. Are you now saying by bringing in these changes that this will redress some of that imbalance?
Well, I hope it will, because our current numbers are 25% of the inmates are blacks, 56% of them are whites, and then the rest are other minorities. And Nebraska has a 10% black population. So it is disproportionate. I wonder if it's a chicken or the egg, though.
That's the sound of the police. That's the sound of the police.
Unlike so many other issues, where President Obama's struggle to strike bipartisan deals, liberals and conservatives at a national level look likely to pass reforms similar to Nebraska's. And in a major break from the law and order consensus of the last 20 years, the president's pardoned some prisoners, while thousands of others convicted of non-violent offences have been released early. But sentencing reform hasn't been the main rallying cry of activists on the streets, who've been protesting in large numbers in the wake of every shooting. The focus of their ire remains the entry point to the system, the very people they say should be there to protect them, the police. And while we were in the Midwest, some of the activists in Kansas City invited me to join them to discuss the problems, and they didn't hold back.
I want to see a lot of different changes, but I think a big one that sticks out to me is I want to see the police stop harassing black people and stop over-policing black people, where the smallest thing can turn into death.
One of the things that I'd really like to see is a major shift in like this concept of like the hero cop, and like everybody worships these people like the, you know, they're above all and they can't do no wrong. So they always get the benefit of the doubt, and that's finally changing in this country. We've got to get everybody to realize that there's a problem, like, before anything's going to happen.
Disarm the police.
Yeah.
Disarm those bastards, because they keep killing us. You know, there are other countries where they use no force almost the whole year. They're not killing people like the police are here. And they're being trained by the military, so I feel like they're being trained to kill us.
What we need in every body cam legislation is a guarantee that there's going to be like a live stream on every single cop available to the public online, or at the very least to like public employees that are, you know, paid and publicly funded to watch cops all the time. So every cop knows that at any time anyone can watch them.
We're just feeding the system. We can replace the players, but it's still the same machine. And it's just going to keep feeding. And so that's why we have to do something completely different and go against the system.
And what they just remember, it's our guarding zones, we're protectors out here. So we want to make sure that everybody's property as well as their person is protected.
It's the morning roll call for police officers serving in North Camden, New Jersey, a majority black and historically very troubled city, midway between New York and Washington, D.C. 3 years ago, Camden closed its old police department and started again with a model which is being heralded as the future of policing in America. I'm about to head out on the beat, on foot patrol, with officers Virginia Matias and Brandon Moreno, to take a look for myself.
All right, guys. Attention. Dismissed.
You know, I want to get to know the residents because, you know, I work here, so I like to know who I'm working for and know what's going on in the area. So the more information I get, the better. The better I'm more likely to do my job and make them, in the end of the day, feel safe. Hello, good morning, good morning. Good morning, ma'am.
Good morning.
How are you doing today?
Oh, blessed by the best.
That's awesome.
What, y'all walking the neighborhood?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, well, that's
making sure you're safe.
All right. So far, so good.
So far, so good? Yeah. Let us know if anything. We'll be around.
All right.
People are more likely to trust you and give you information. If you come off with a bad attitude, they're not going to tell you anything, and they're going to just basically ignore you as well. So that's not something we do here.
Virginia's colleague Brandon worked for the old Camden Force, and I asked him how the training was different now. He told me about a new program called Ethical Protector.
It's a training program that introduces more of a new way of thinking, you know, even in your personal life, but as well as at work, a different way of looking at people, going on the basis that we're not out here to be warriors, you know, enforcing laws. We're out here to be guardians, to protect the people. It teaches you a different way to speak to people when you're conducting a stop. It gives you a different approach to it. And there's different techniques, just simple things that they teach you to do, like just a simple body gesture can help de-escalate a situation, and something that you wouldn't even think of.
Give us an example of a body gesture that you've been taught then.
If you're telling somebody to calm down, and you're going like this and saying, stop, calm down, it may not have any difference.
Just to describe, you're talking about when an officer has their hands in the air and they're kind of pushing away.
With their palms down.
With their palms down. And instead, it's face up.
If you open up your palms, you're opening up yourself, you're being more welcoming to them. It feels more sincere.
More sincere, more trusting, officers seeing themselves as guardians rather than warriors. Why aren't more police forces following Camden's lead? Well, to find out, I'm heading over the river to Philadelphia. In 2014, President Obama asked the city's police chief, Commissioner Charles Ramsey, to come up with a plan for the future of American policing. He recommended a series of changes on everything from rebuilding public trust to using technology like body cameras. But now that he's figured out what should be done, how can Commissioner Ramsey persuade 18,000 different police forces across the country to get on board?
Well, we won't get them all. I mean, 18,000, I mean, to actually think you're going to reach everybody is probably not realistic.
What's the kind of legal mechanism? Do they have to adopt these policies?
Well, no, they don't. In our country, there's really nothing that's going to mandate and would take a federal law, and I doubt if that's going to happen now. I've been very active, as well as other members of the task force, major police organizations, going around the country, talking to chiefs, talking to sheriffs, explaining the steps they can take in order to really be consistent with the recommendations that are found in the report, as well as other recommendations that perhaps we didn't make. But how can we better serve the communities here, especially focusing on those six key areas? We've made a lot of progress. Now, nothing's absolute, you know, and it doesn't mean that all problems go away overnight, because they won't.
The report up there, signed by the president, there's a message on there that we read, which said, I think this will make a difference. How will this make a difference?
It will make a difference. It'll make a difference because, one, it opens dialogue. It's thoughtful discussion around some very serious issues. We just can't afford to let it get stalled. The one thing the president made very clear, one, he wanted the report to be concrete, have some real recommendations, solid recommendations. And two, this is not going to be a report to sit on a shelf. I was on a conference call just yesterday with the White House. What are we doing to push this forward? I mean, that was just yesterday I was on that, and we have that call at least once a month, if not more.
I then asked Commissioner Ramsey what he made of the Black Lives Matter campaign, which has been at the forefront of calls for change.
All black lives matter. And so when we try to segregate or isolate one small percentage that may be the result of some police action, it doesn't change the overall dynamic. In this country, anywhere between 12 and 15,000 homicides occur every single year, and the vast majority of them are people of color. We cannot keep our head in the sand and pretend as if police are driving the problem. I mean, we may be part of, in some instances, there's no question that we've had some shootings that were unjustified, that should not have occurred. So if officers are acting in an inappropriate way, then it's up to me and it's up to people like me in the same position to take appropriate action and let them know that kind of behavior is not going to be tolerated. But at the same time, you can't ignore the larger problem. And right now, that's what I see. So if you want to have the dialogue, want to be and really have a real solution, then look at the hard fact and truth of what's going on in many of our communities. And a lot of it is black-on-black crime. And there's folks that don't want to hear it. I'm African-American myself, and I've been African-American longer than most of them folks out there on the picket line. So I'm not proud to say that. But I was born and raised in Chicago, same problem there. Worked in Washington, D.C., same issue. Philadelphia, no different. Go to New York, go to L.A., go to any city that has a diverse population and has issues of poverty, poor educational systems and all that, and you'll see the same thing. We got to fix it. We got to fix it all. And I'm glad you're looking at this from the perspective of not just police, but also housing and education and poverty.
Commissioner Ramsey's surely right. Policing and criminal justice aren't isolated issues when it comes to America's race problem. And many people I've spoken to in the past few years here cite economic opportunity, or a lack of it, as one of the key problems, which is why in the next part of America in Black and White on the BBC World Service, I'll be looking at just that. America in Black and White on the BBC World Service was presented by me, Rajini Vaidyanathan, and produced by Giles Edwards.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. The details of them all go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.